And welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's our Pets and Vets program for this month, and here to take your calls is Dr. Ron Scharf. Ron is from the Animal Hospital of Niskayuna, New York. He's a 1985 graduate of the Veterinary College at Cornell with extensive experience in conventional and more unconventional veterinary medicine, I guess alternative, you would say. Dr. Scharf is always a great guest, and he's always in high demand. So give us a call early, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also check in online at wamc.org/voxpop. It's the place where you can get all the info on how to check in via social media. Please provide as much info as you can on your pet if checking in, say, via Twitter, where you only have X number of characters. Try to give us as much as you can, including the age and sex of your pet, if you're submitting a question online. Dr. Scharf, welcome back on a beautiful, beautiful Wednesday.
It is gorgeous, Ray. Thanks so much for such an effusive welcome, which I always get from you. It's such a pleasure.
Indeed.
I feel actually welcome here.
Well, it's scripted, but I try to make it sound like it's
other. Keywords.
We have calls already, so let's go right to the phones. Judith and Saugerties, you're first.
Hi. Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
I have two cats. They're a sister and brother. They're 12 years old. And each one has a right eye problem. They're different. The boy cat, his name is Orion, he has, on his right eye, it's always slightly raw and slightly swollen, or at least it looks slightly swollen. I notice that he scratches it. I've been treating it with polysporin and occasionally hydrocortisone ointment, and that seems to have helped, but I just looked, in fact he's sitting on my desk this minute, and there it is. So there's one or two raw spots down to the skin, and so that's been going on for a long time. I've taken him to the vet and there doesn't seem to be a solution. The solution is basically what I told you, which is the, polysporin and the hydrocortisone ointment. So that's one issue. And then very recently, like in the last week or two, my other cat, his sister, has developed a different kind of eye issue also in her right eye. Mm. That's kind of like an oozy. It looks, where a cat kind of, she's never had anything like oozing out of her eyes. Now all of a sudden she has in the right eye. So it seems to be two separate issues, but the vet could not figure out. I had Orion in to the vet. I haven't had his sister in. The vet could not figure out what it was. So I just wondered if you have any clue.
Okay.
Okay, Judith, how is your right eye?
My right eye?
Okay, there's nothing that's spread around the house or anything like that, is there? In terms of something that might be affecting anyone else besides the cats?
I don't think so, no.
Okay. Well, it's not likely that things spread from one species to another, but you're talking right eyes here. I wanted to make sure. So, Orion, right. Did you get Orion or the both of them when they were kittens?
Yes.
And did he have that problem at that time?
No.
And so how old was he when he got it?
I would say he's now about almost 12, but I'd say he developed it in the last few months.
Ah, okay.
And she developed it, Onyx developed it in the last week or so.
Okay. And although you said it was Orion's right eye, when you started talking about spots down to the skin and using hydrocortisone, it made me more wonder, are you talking about the eyelid as opposed to the eye?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And so I would wonder what the appearance would look like. Of course, over the radio, it's hard to, perform. It's impossible to perform an exam. It's a challenge to get an accurate picture of what that eye looks like. But is there any seasonal variation, or is it just kind of constant since you noticed it a few months ago?
Well, actually, that's a good question. I would say for Orion, it has not been seasonal because it's been for a few months. So it was I think it was before allergy season.
Okay.
And the way it looks is the lid is slightly puffy, and then there's spots that are actually one or two spots that are red. They are also indoor-outdoor cats.
Well, yeah, I was just about to ask you, because if they go outdoors, two factors could be at play. Number one, he's coming into contact with other cats.
Mm.
And number two, he's coming into contact with the rest of the world, the woods, the places where the branches are, the places where I can get poked, etc. However,
always the right eye.
I understand. I didn't remember hearing you, Judith, say that you use systemic antibiotics. Anything oral? Any orally administered?
No, I haven't given him anything oral.
That's the first thing I would do, because it could be a bacterial infection. An infection of the eyelid is called the blepharitis, and it might be just a simple fix, giving him a week and a half or two of a correctly chosen antibiotic. The one I usually go to first is Clavamox. It's what you call Augmentin in people, though it's a bit of a different ratio as the two medications in there, Augmentin versus Clavamox, but it's similar. And number one. Number two, there are diagnostics that could be done, Judith, if you really wanted to get at the root of it. A culture and sensitivity could be done. Even a PCR, a relatively recent high-tech kind of thing, polymerase chain reaction, can tell you, does he have any of the big guns of those seven or eight infectious agents that can cause eye problems? But that's usually more for a globe, a problem in the eyeball itself. Whether it would avail you for a lid problem is hard to say. I would just take it simple and go with an antibiotic as far as he was concerned. And then the other question is, could she have gotten what he has? You know, you say they might look different, but all I know about hers is that it's oozy. So are we talking a lid problem in her, or are we talking that it's oozing from the globe itself?
It looks like it's from the globe itself.
Well, then it could be a conjunctivitis, what you would call a pink eye in people, or in cows for that matter.
Yeah.
And that might be something that the triple antibiotic ointment that you're using on him, assuming that's what you meant when you said polysporin, could be all she needs. However, they can also, cats that is, get infectious problems in their eyes, which we humans have heard about in different contexts. But a herpes virus can cause respiratory problems in a cat. And a chlamydia can cause respiratory problems in a cat, and so can mycoplasma. And the latter two, the chlamydia and the mycoplasma, will not respond to something like a Clavamox, but will respond to a tetracycline-type medication.
Okay.
So something in that eye or in both of their eyes that's of a tetracycline family may be the way to go.
Okay, Judith, thanks a lot. Now, of course, you think it's merely a coincidence that it was the right eye for both cats?
Of course.
Okay. Let's go to Amy in Ellenville. Amy.
Hi there.
Hello.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a four-year-old, well, she's almost four-year-old golden retriever, and in the past year, she has been experiencing seizures. The most frequent part the occasions have been 6 weeks, and the last one just happened on Monday, and we've decided now to put her on anti-seizure meds. My question is, should we wait until seizures come closer together before putting her on phenobarbital, which I understand we're not to take her off of when she started? And then what do I look for if we do put her on the phenobarbital, besides being lethargic, what other symptoms might I look for that's not an effective treatment?
Hey, Amy, would you be comfortable listening off the phone? We're getting some strange beeps on your call.
Absolutely.
Okay, thanks. All right, go ahead, doctor.
Okay, so Amy, every veterinarian has their own criteria when it is worthwhile starting someone on anti-seizure medication. The purpose of the anti-seizure medication is not to eradicate all seizures. The purpose is to just get them down to a manageable frequency. There are three guidelines that I use when I decide when it's time to put someone on anticonvulsants. Number one is if the frequency gets to more than four times a year, in other words, more often than every 3 months. Number two is if any of those seizures are lasting longer than 4 minutes. Anything longer than 4 minutes, I get concerned about, because if they continue having that seizure beyond 5 minutes, there could be irreversible damage to the brain. Now, this is exceedingly rare.
Mm.
It's called status epilepticus, and I don't want you all out there to be worried that you're animal's going to get it, but it's another, the second of the criteria that I use. And then the third is whether or not to get in cluster seizures. If they get in cluster episodes, in other words, one seizure after another in a very short time on the same day, then all those three things are grounds for starting them on medication. You are right, Amy, if you're still there, I assume you are, that once you start an anticonvulsant medication, you're locked in because there is a higher risk of having a seizure if you stop or miss some doses. So once you start, you have to keep taking?
What if you take the wrong one? I mean, can you adjust dosage or
Oh, yeah, you can adjust doses, and you could change anti-seizure medication. It's just that if you start someone on something, and phenobarb that she mentioned is the most common, that if you miss a dose or two, then that animal's at a higher risk of getting a seizure at that time.
Okay. So if it was a temporary thing causing the seizures, and then you put the animal on something like that,
you can wean them off. No, you can wean them off.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely, you can wean them off. It's just a general guideline. It doesn't mean that they will have a seizure if you miss a dose or two. It just means they're at an increased risk. So it's a guideline that we give to people to just have dog owners or cat owners have the awareness that you do want to be regular about your dosing and compliant.
Dr. Ron Scharf is our guest. It's Vox Pop Pets and Vets. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. More coming up.
Support for WAMC comes from Agway, Millerton, Chatham, Claverack, New York, and Great Barrington, Massachusetts, offering pet supplies from bedding to flea and tick control, foods from Wellness, Blue Buffalo, Evo, Science Diet, Taste of the Wild, and Primal Raw Diet, agwayny.com. New York State Canal Corporation, featuring the journey of the replica canal schooner, Lois McClure, through the Erie Canal this summer. Cruise the past, unlock the adventure, canals.ny.gov. College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts, specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repair services and 24-hour towing and recovery service for over 30 years, collegestreetmotors.com. The Pirates Lakeside Grill at Nassau Lake, with local organic grass-fed beef burgers, pastured pork hot dogs, Wurst Plate, and featuring the Hot Fudge Sundo, open Thursday through Sunday, noon to 8 p.m., PiratesLakesideGrill.com. National Museum of Dance, Saratoga Springs, New York, presenting current exhibits Andrew DeVries, Homage to Dance, On Point, The History of Dance, Art in the Foyer with Jordan Matter, and the Hall of Fame, DanceMuseum.org. And the Office of Dr. Vivian Letizia, Woodstock, Orthodontic, Cosmetic, and General Dentistry, featuring laser and digital technologies, WoodstockDentist.com.
One 1-800-348-2551 is our number. Dr. Ron Scharf is here. It's Pets and Vets, and back to the phones we go. Teresa in Richmondville, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a 13-year-old shepherd mix who has arthritis in his hips and his back legs. He was on a daily dose of carprofen, but we discontinued it because it was causing nausea. And we were at the vet recently discussing options, and she recommended a different supplement called, it's called Ventry, E-N-S-E-D.
Okay.
And I was wondering if you had ever heard of it or if you had any other recommendations.
I'm sorry, was that one word, Ventry, E-N-S-E-D?
It's Ventry dash, and then that's an acronym, E-N-S-E-D.
Hmm.
Well, ENSED is a, and the word NSAID is, it sounds to me like another spelling for what people are, make an acronym out of the term non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug.
Hmm.
So non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug is abbreviated as an NSAID. That is the family of medications where aspirin is the original one.
Mm-hmm.
Including ibuprofen and Celebrex, et cetera. And we do have ones made for dogs, of which carprofen is one of them. That is the generic form, what you had mentioned, Teresa, of Rimadyl. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whenever I am thinking about NSAIDs for my patients, I maintain a very healthy paranoia because I believe that forewarned is forearmed. Animals get ulcers easily, much more easily than people.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever I start someone on an NSAID, I mention that it's very important to give it with a meal, number one. Number two, it's important to check for any vomiting or diarrhea or loss of appetite, which obviously the carprofen in your pup got. And number three, I'll periodically check with a blood sample of liver and kidney function because there are five or so animals, dogs, out of 10,000 for whom a kidney or a liver problem can happen after they begin. It's some kind of idiosyncratic result. It was first seen when carprofen, actually when Rimadyl, came out at first, and the most common animal, the most common breed, rather, was labs. I don't shy away from giving labs NSAIDs. As a matter of fact, they are some of the hardiest dogs I know. Some of these labs get to, 14, 15, 16 years old. Mm-hmm. So when they get that old, they're riddled with arthritis. And those NSAIDs sometimes are one of the only things that'll keep them going, other than other things such as acupuncture and a few other measures. So it's possible, Teresa, that your pup will not have as much of a reaction to a different kind of NSAID, this Ventry NSAID that you mentioned I am totally unaware of. I personally have a choice of two or three NSAIDs in my practice, one of which is called Deramax for Derecoxib. The other one is called Medicam, whose generic form, which I also carry, is Meloxicam. It's much cheaper. Okay, but in any case, even just switching from one NSAID to the other, it is recommended to have what's called a washout period of 5 days, meaning 5 days during which the animal's getting neither of those. That's how much of a respect, so to speak, we have in the veterinary profession about the use of NSAIDs, and we cannot under almost any circumstances use an NSAID with a steroidally anti-inflammatory. So in other words, like a prednisone plus an NSAID.
What'll happen?
That would be a recipe for an ulcer happening. I've seen it before. I've had patients before. And I have these vivid images blazoned in my memory that make me very, very careful about warning people about those possibilities. So I don't know what to tell you if it was just a carprofen problem or maybe, Teresa, you're not giving it with meal. But there are others that I would try, and if your pup gets problems, your 13-year-old German Shepherd, which is a pretty respectable age, gets problems with other NSAIDs, there are other types of painkillers or things that could be used, such as glucosamine chondroitin sulfate. And
yeah, he's already on that.
Good. And Adequin is an injectable that's given by a veterinarian that's very helpful for these older animals with bad arthritis, and then there's acupuncture. So there are several other measures. But you might want to try a different NSAID carefully after your shepherd's been off the carprofen for at least 5 days or a week. Give it with a meal, see what happens, take a blood sample, and then good luck.
Okay. Well, Teresa, thanks very much for the call. Let's go over to Tara in Tilson, New York. Tara, you're on.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi,
okay.
Tara.
I try to do the best I can for my animals, but my budget's getting really tight. And I've been thinking about getting some of my prescriptions from PetMeds, and I didn't know if that was really the best way to go. I wanted to know your opinion.
So, Tara,
what is PetMeds, first of all? I have no idea.
PetMeds is an online. It's an online place.
Okay.
You dial an 800 number, and they have cut rate prices.
I understand. Okay.
Now, Tara, I would have to admit, in full disclosure, that you're not talking to an entirely unbiased person, because a lot of veterinarians are in a bit of a quandary as far as places like PetMeds, and there are several reasons why. Number one, that this is an interruption of the veterinarian client-patient relationship. So in other words, ethics. Our ethics in the veterinary field dictate that there be a veterinarian client-patient relationship established before any medication could be dispensed or medicine practiced. And places like PetMeds sometimes get in the way of a valid vet-client-patient relationship. And I've even seen instances where medications, such as heartworm preventive, could be sent to someone without a veterinarian's prescription. And that could be extremely dangerous, as one example, giving heartworm medication.
Well, I do have to be honest that I was a bit surprised on what they offered. Some of these things I would assume they would want you to see a doctor first.
Absolutely. And they just want to make money. Now, listen, I'm not saying that veterinarians are all not-for-profit businesses. Don't get me wrong. But I do think that there's way more concern on the parts of veterinarians for their patients than there is from PetMeds. They don't care about your patient. They just care, about getting their bottom line. And
okay.
That's it.
But in fairness, this is a problem of laws more than it is of business, right? Because if In other words, it's legal to do what they do. So is it not that incumbent upon the owner to make sure that the owner is getting the proper thing for their pet?
It is incumbent, yes, I agree, Ray. However, the state does take some responsibility for ensuring that fraudulent or improper practices don't take place. And I've seen that. Not only cases in which they dispense things without a prescription, but I've also heard of fraudulent things where, whether it's pet meds or other places, are sending things which are they're imposters. They're things with forged labels. They're, I don't know if the medication is coming from China and has not undergone FDA regulation.
All right. We're treading on delicate legal ground here. So make sure that you know you have evidence to back all this up in case there are any subpoenas being served.
I do. As a matter of fact, at my practice, we have a laminated sheet from the FDA about the dangers that people can avoid by dealing with online or catalog places.
Now, and there are more than one, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
There's a lot of them.
Not singling out any
one. Not at all.
Okay. Interesting aspect. But interestingly, there really is, like, if you're a pet owner in, say, New York State, you can just get whatever you want. In other words, you don't have to go to a doctor, and the doctor would say, your pet needs this, here's a prescription, like you would for a people doctor.
With a few exceptions, someone in New York State cannot get any drug they want. And the exceptions are things that have been changed from by prescription only, such as antihistamines like Benadryl, to over-the-counter. I mean, Benadryl and some of the other antihistamines used to be by prescription only. Some of them still are.
For pets.
Okay? For people.
Well, I'm not, I know the deal with people, that there are some over-the-counter.
So some things can be gotten over-the-counter, but it is a small minority.
Interesting. All right. Dr. Ron Scharf is our guest. Stuart in Newburgh is up. Stuart.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a rather crazy calico who's about 9 years old, and she was a rescue. I picked her up off the streets of Brooklyn, and she's an incredibly sweet cat. But when I try to put her in a carrying case to take her to the vet or to take her to Newburgh, where my studio is, she turns into a cougar. I've gotten bitten a number of times, once quite severely. So I'm kind of looking for strategies. I've tried to put a towel over her, and it's what the vet does, and he does it much better than I do. And you need to take her to the vet now because she's got a toe problem. Her toenail keeps falling off and bleeding, and I don't know whether it's a fungal thing or something like that. But anyway, you have any ideas?
Yes. First of all, before I give you some ideas, Stuart, how long has your 9-year-old been having an aversion to get into a carrier?
Forever. I mean, we guesstimated, or the vet guesstimated when I adopted her, that she was a year and a half. So ever since I've had her, you know, she's a skittish cat. She hides most of the time. She comes out really when, you know, my wife and daughter go to bed and I'm the only one around.
Okay.
And she's incredibly affectionate. But when you try to grab her, when you try to force her into a carrier, she's a tiger.
Okay. So it seems to me that something could be done about it, Stuart, but you would have 9 years of a kind of a psychological habit to overcome, which makes it much more challenging. What I would do is take the least threatening carrier you can find. And in general, I think in some ways the least threatening carrier is these just foldable cardboard carriers that a lot of stores and a lot of vets carry, because when you open the top, you have the full top and the full dimensions of the box that into which you could lower the cat. Some of these plastic carriers, which are more they're tougher and they resist destruction more, but they have such little tiny doors that some cats get a little paranoid about getting stuffed into it. So you want to get one that's big enough for the animal in any case, number one. Number two, you want to leave that carrier lying around the house and put your cat's favorite chew toy, favorite catnip toy, favorite treat inside. You want to coax that cat into that box. Okay, and after 9 years of staying away from the box, it's going to take you a long time, but you need to work at it, and you need to find out, figure out, be a detective, play around with what are the things that will get the cat even close to the box, and then just do whatever you can to try to get her in. And then when she's in, you try to do it as often as you can. You're basically breaking down 9 years of aversion. She had some bad experience with a box, obviously, at some point, and that's all she remembers. You need to give her a flood of positive memories with the box. Mm. And then when she's in the box, don't take her to the vet. Take her for a spin around the block. Take her home. It took 2 minutes, and then she's done. So she could see, oh, I was in the box, and nothing happened bad at the end of that trip. And then take her for 3 minutes around the box, and then five, and then take her across town, and you know, just acclimate her to it. And after you acclimate her to it, you flood her. It's called desensitization. And I'm telling you, it'll take a long time, but I think it is
doable.
Will
the cat live long enough for this?
Yep.
The cat may or may not live long enough.
I've done this with my other cat, who's also a rescue, and it's worked very well with her.
Oh, good.
This particular cat is just, the moment I try to actually hold her and put her in, she goes crazy.
Yeah, I understand.
I mean, should I just grab her by the scruff really firmly?
No, not unless you have training. Not unless you have a lot of training and you're willing to get bitten.
Oh, boy.
So how do I grab her? How do I put her in? Because when I hold her by the body, that's when she'll turn around and bite me.
Oh, she's biting you. Well, I'm a little leery.
She bit me quite severely. It took a lot of antibiotics to actually
cure
her once.
Why don't you get in the box?
Yeah.
All I could say, okay, so what I see some people doing, Stuart, is having a box that is openable at the top. The top half can be taken apart, unlatched from the bottom half. And you just take it off, and you just set her down in that big bottom half, and then you, hopefully, maybe with an accomplice, put the top half on before she's had a chance to stick her head or paw out. I wouldn't want any amputations to happen. But try to see if you could coax her into that bottom half with all those treats and tricks, and just do it like that and work at it gradually. And you could even use tranquilizers to aid in your behavior modification attempt.
I use some herbal tranquilizer. It's just a thing you put in her food. But, I mean, what other kind of tranquilizers would you suggest?
Well, other than ones that your vet can prescribe to you, which are stronger, I'll often use Pet Rescue Remedy, which is a bit of a somewhat like a homeopathic remedy that you can get around town. Rescue
Remedy. Is that
the
little paste that you put on something?
It's just a drop or two anywhere in the mouth or on the mucosa. And there are some essential oils that are sometimes good for calming a cat down. I use one at work called Peace and Calm. It's made by Young Essentials, I think, but there are other brands also. But these are more alternative things, Stuart. They're not things that have a sledgehammer effect like the drugs. You know, the drugs, the medications like Ace Promazine, or Ace for short, is the most common one vets use, and that would be the one that your vet could prescribe if her heart situation is healthy.
Okay. Stuart, thanks a lot and good luck. Now, if a cat begins biting, is that a red flag that
the
kitty should not be sticking around for long?
That the kitty should not be
sticking
around
for long. In other words, should you bring the cat back to the shelter? In other words, if you're being bitten,
okay,
should you bring the cat back to the shelter and say, look, this cat is biting me?
It's a very complex question, Ray. It's not a simple yes or no. I think that if a cat was just gotten from the shelter within the past few days or the past week or so, and you find that it's got this intractable aggression, then I would say yes. That is an option to consider.
Yeah.
Okay. On the other hand, you've had a cat for 9 years. It's part of the family.
Yeah.
You got a spouse. You got a kid. Everyone's established bonds. And everything else is fine except for in this one limited circumstance of the cat defending itself, so to speak, on its way into the box or to the vet. No, I don't think that that's necessarily grounds for rehoming or bringing the cat back to the shelter. I mean, this is a family member. This is someone that a lot of people are willing to overlook. I'm amazed by the abuse that people take from their animals sometimes. I include myself. I mean, we just put up with a lot from our animals, so I can't just stick my hand up and say, here's where the line is, because everyone's got a line in a different place.
Okay, let's get one more call in before the break. Karen in Pittsfield, you're on with Ron Scharf.
Oh, hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling about our dog. He's about 8 to 10 years old. We don't know exactly because he was found as a stray. So we've had him for the past 2 years now. And over the past 2 months or so, he's developed a really bad hacking. It's not his usual cough, but it's a really bad hacking. And when he has a spell of it, it just goes on and on, and he hacks like every 2 seconds. And well, I guess he's a smaller dog. They think he's a Sheltie mix, and about 18 pounds. So they thought, well, his regular cough, they said it's because he has a small trachea, because he's a smaller dog, and that it was because of that. But then when he developed this greater hacking condition that he has now, they thought, well, maybe he has an enlarged heart, or maybe he has fluid in the lungs, and so he had an ultrasound for those and was found not to have either of those problems. So we're wondering what other direction we could go with this.
Okay.
Well, the small trachea, Karen, would be something that you could pick up with regular x-rays, okay? However, your typical case of a collapsing trachea is a goose honk-like sound. So they will have this cough and then honk like that, and it doesn't mean that they have to have that goose honk in order to say that it's a collapsing trachea, but that's the typical presentation. But like I say, you could diagnose that on a simple x-ray. If the dog already had an ultrasound, I would imagine that an x-ray has already been performed. Now, heart disease is less likely in my mind, and the same with pulmonary edema, because I think of those as more softer and less dry coughs. Whereas when you say a hack, I think of a very dry cough, such as a kind of thing. Now, that kind of dry hack is typically what I find with cases of bronchitis. Bronchitis, there are several forms, and one could be an allergic bronchitis, which is otherwise known as asthma. So I would look into asthma as a possibility, and sometimes that could be picked up on an x-ray with suggestive appearance of what those lungs and chest look like. You could also just use an empirical course of medication and see whether or not that does it. We'll typically use a cortisone-like medication like prednisone.
Well, he and was on Temeril P for a time to see if that would help.
And did it help?
It didn't seem to, no.
Well, then it's not likely that it's an asthma. Okay, so that's a good thing because it helps whittle down the list of possibilities. There are other types of bronchitises, and it might be that you might have to get a little more diagnostic, a little more aggressive diagnostically by doing something, either a scope, that's a bronchoscope, so that someone can peek down there and see what's looking, what the walls of the airways are looking like, and try to get a sample of what's in those airways to see whether or not it suggests more of an infectious cause or more of an allergic cause or other things. There are a lot of things, or something called a transtracheal wash, in which a needle is inserted into the bottom of the trachea and to harvest some of that fluid, and also to put it under a microscope and see whether some kinds of clues can be gleaned. So those are the two things that I would consider, either a bronchoscopy, Karen, or transtracheal wash. They're not terribly unusual things to do, and they should give you diagnosis.
All right, Karen, we got to go. We got to take a break here. We're overdue. Zach, the engineer, please have at it. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. 800-348-2551. The home stretch with Dr. Sharp and Pets and Vets coming up.
Support for WAMC comes from Bow Wow Bathhouse Resort and Daycare, South Deerfield, Massachusetts. For over 7 years, providing 10 hours of daily indoor-outdoor play, professional grooming, and retail shop, the BowWowBathhouse.com. Bethel Wood Center for the Arts, presenting Joan Baez and the Indigo Girls, performing on the Pavilion Stage, Saturday, June 22nd at 8 p.m., BethelWoodCenter.org. Cafe Capriccio, offering dining and catering with Tuscan cuisine in Albany, New York, and Neapolitan cuisine in Saratoga Springs. CafeCapriccio.com for reservations. NBT Bank, offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses. NBTBank.com. The Blue Marble, Amherst, Massachusetts, featuring goods from across the country and around the globe with a concentration on handcrafted American-made and fair trade items, a world of gifts. TheBlueMarble.biz. And Adelphi University Hudson Valley Center's Graduate Social Work Program and Graduate and Undergraduate Nursing Programs. Hosting an open house Tuesday, July 9th, 6 p.m., St. Francis Hospital Pavilion. connect.adelphi.edu/Hudson Valley Events.
Well done, Ron Scharf, pegging Zappa, the Grand Wazoo here on Vox Pop. 1-800-348-2551. Renee via Facebook checks in, says, regarding online pet pharmacies, I purchase meds for chronic conditions. They always ask for a written prescription. The medication has always been properly labeled. This is a pet meds. My own rule of thumb is to get the meds originally from my vet and then compare to the med that I receive from online pharmacy. So thank you, Renee, for checking in via Facebook today. And you want to comment, or you good?
I think that I'm glad that Kate's had a good that Renee's had a good experience. I do think that the majority are positive. It's just that it's a little relinquishment of the bond between the doctor and the patient, so that it provides more opportunity for problem or miscommunication in terms of side effects, things to expect, such as, for example, the things that I mentioned earlier about NSAIDs. You usually don't get that kind of warning from a catalog or an online.
Yeah.
Or maybe you get it, but they give you several reams of pages with very tiny print. And then
every medication.
Right.
Yeah.
It might not be read. It might look too daunting. So it's just that's my main thing is the welfare of the animals, how they're doing.
Well, this is an overall – you could transpose this to online medications for humans as well. So
absolutely.
This is a problem.
Absolutely.
I guess because I don't own a pet, I don't know how the vets work. In other words, when you have a patient and you say this patient needs XYZ, you have to write a script, right?
Yes.
You do?
Yes. You have to write a script. When the catalogs came out, and the catalogs came out before online, so we're going back, 8 or 10 years?
Yeah.
A lot of vets start thinking, well, you know, we should be charging for writing prescriptions. And the majority of veterinarians did not charge because they thought that it would incur ill will, et cetera. And,
well, isn't that part of what a doctor does? I mean, you write
the script. That was the philosophical discussion that a lot of people had. Now I find my own doc is charging me for writing a prescription for
$5. I didn't know that. I'm going to the doctor later.
So
I'm going to be watching the bottom line.
You got to wonder. You know, I mean, because you're putting all your effort and time into giving warnings about something that some other companies going to get the economic benefit from.
I see.
You're putting the time in, they're getting the income.
I hear you, man. Let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. It's Kate and Lennox with an interesting one. Hi, Kate, you're on.
Hi.
Okay.
Regardless of my question, I wanted to make a mention about pet meds as well. I was of the understanding that some of the medications that you get and some of the flea things that you get, if you buy them from PetMeds, the company won't stand behind them. But I don't know that's true, but I heard that. Is that true?
That is an excellent point, Kate, that I'm glad that you brought up, that a lot of the companies, and these are the big companies, your Novartis, your Merck, your Pfizer, which is now called, the animal division of Pfizer is now called Zoetis. It's true that they will stand behind their product if there is a valid client veterinarian patient relationship. So for instance, heartworm. A lot of these companies, they give the heartworm and they say, if your dog's on our product of heartworm and it's on it 12 months a year and comes up sick with any of those things, not just heartworm, but some of the hookworms, the roundworms, the extras, the extra parasites that those heartworm medications protect against, the company will pay for all the diagnostics and they'll give you a free 6-month supply. Now,
right.
The company will not stand behind their product if it's gotten out of channels. And that's what these catalogs and online things are. They're out of channel. It's not
right.
It's not that the drug companies, the pharmaceutical companies, are necessarily selling to those places.
Well, how do they get them then?
It's diverted. It's a diversion problem, and it's something that's a big problem.
Well, I mean, there should be laws. If I'm company X and I say, well, I'm only letting XYZ retailers sell stuff,
right,
then and somebody else sells it, I'm within my rights to say you can't sell that.
Right. You should be able to. What happens is they send out letters to veterinarians, and those letters says, you want to make more income? Here's what you do. You buy us a ton of product X for us, and then sell it to us, and you will make a major profit. And they do. They make a lot of money.
Oh, I see.
So the companies are then in the position of trying to track down which vets are doing it, and they try to put technology into their products. So some of these companies, to their credit, are putting tracking devices in each package of medication so they could find out which vet did it so that they could blackball that vet.
All right. Now, to be clear, I think that if we're going to seriously make some of these allegations against specific companies, we really have to have that company be able to respond. So I really don't want to get into specific companies here at this point. Now, you had an interesting question that Callie put on the board, and frankly, it raised my eyebrows. So let's go to that.
I have a question about inbreeding in cats. Now, I know that there are feral cat populations, and I'm sure that they don't make a delineation between mom and son and brother and sister. However, I have a friend who had a cat, and we believe that her son was the father of her second litter. We're not 100% sure of that, but that's what we believe. She no longer has the son. But when the kittens were born, there were five kittens. The firstborn was a large kitten, and he died within 24 hours. He appeared absolutely fine, but he just died within 24 hours. The last kitten that was born was half the size of the rest of the kittens. She looks like she's Persian, but there's no Persian that we're aware of. She has a very flat face. She has nystagmus. Her eyes twitch. When she first started to walk, she circled, sometimes to the left, sometimes to the right. Now she runs around in place, but I'm not convinced that she can see. Is that something that could happen from inbreeding, or is that something that just happens with cats?
It's either or, Kate. The thing is that problems such as that happen more often when things are inbred, but because something's inbred doesn't guarantee that there's going to be a problem.
Now, when seem fine.
Okay, when the fifth kitten came out half the size, well, that could just be a runt of the litter. Okay,
right.
That can happen without inbreeding. Okay.
Well, we also wondered if she just wasn't quote unquote cooked. If she was from a later breeding or something, is that possible as well?
No.
Okay.
Can't have a different breeding produce kittens in the same litter.
So once you're preggers, you're preggers.
Yeah, she's still much smaller, and now she actually plays, but she doesn't seem. I mean, I think that she can see, but because of the nystagmus, her eyes almost don't focus together, I think, is what the problem is.
It's a nystagmus, you're right. And that's a problem of the vestibular system. That's part of the brain going to the inner ear.
Now, that's not something that would go away.
Well,
it's
hard to say.
She's a couple months old now, and she does run and play, and she does run in straight lines, but I'm just not convinced that she can see very well.
I would imagine that it's unlikely in my mind that it will ever be perfect, but that it's not out of the question that the brain can try to compensate, try to form new neural circuits, but I wouldn't expect it to ever totally go away. But I would like to clarify something I said a minute ago. If two different breedings happen soon after, one after the other, within a couple days or something,
then
it is possible, I think, to have more than one sire involved in the same litter.
Right.
But
right.
after a few days, it is out of the question. You can't...
That's possible?
Yes, you can't have half of a litter be 8 weeks along and the other half of the litter be 4 weeks along.
Okay.
Amazing.
Well, we honestly thought that she would die. We did not expect her to survive, and we actually supplemented feeding her, and she's absolutely adorable. She's a calico, and she's got the greatest face and the nicest personality, but I don't know. I just worry that there'll be other issues that she'll have.
Well, there could be. There could be, Kate. Well, let me tell you of an instructive case that I had. It was a very sad week for me because I got years ago a Bernese Mountain Dog that was born with a cerebellar problem. So the cerebellum is part of the brain that covers balance, and if it's off, then someone's balance could be off. They could have tremor. They could have an intention tremor, and they could have a weird hypermetric kind of gait. And this dog is not supposed to live more than a year or two, and came to me at about that age, and we tried alternative things. We tried acupuncture. We tried other things. And this dog had a slow, inexorable decline to the point that she was finally euthanized this past week at the age of 8. Now, for a burner, for a giant breed dog, that's actually a somewhat normal life expectancy.
It is, actually.
So it
was
amazing. She was the sweetest. She was the sweetest dog. I will not get into trouble by saying that her name was Ayla, A-Y-L-A, and she was owned by the sweetest, most devoted parents, and they went through so much with her. And the fact that they were able to nurse her along until she was 8 years of age was amazing. At the end, she couldn't get up on her own. Mm-hmm. They had a carrier. This is an 80-pound dog. So, but it's just something that it's impossible to predict, but it's also, Kate, impossible to predict how much any given individual person is able and wanting to put up with those kinds of challenges. I mean,
right.
Animals are born with birth defects all the time, and people are amazing. They just go with them. But you also want to bear in mind, the last thing I was going to mention, Kate, is that animals' reproductive strategy, dogs and cats, is different than ours. We put all of our eggs in one basket, so to speak. We generally have one offspring, and everything is riding on that one offspring, whereas dogs and cats, they're multiparous. They have many puppies or kittens, and it's expected that one or two in the litter are not going to do well and hopefully, so to speak, not make it, because that is how nature works. So it's kind of a different thing.
Would you suggest sooner rather than later getting her checked out by a veterinarian?
Absolutely.
Anything else? Okay.
Absolutely.
All right, then. Well, we were thinking about doing that, and like I said, she's like 8 or 9 weeks old now.
Mm-hmm. It's a perfect time. It's a perfect time to do it.
Outpaced her. I mean, they're three times her size now. She's still very tiny. So.
All right, Kate.
All right, well, thank you very much.
Sure, Kate. Good luck. Good for you. Good work.
It's Carol in Plattsburgh. Carol, you're on.
Whoops, sorry. I had on speaker to hear you.
Hi.
There's three things. One, we have an eating disorder cat, so maybe I should talk about that
first.
Yes. We rescue all our animals, and this calico was part of a larger litter that my husband accidentally, I'll say, without telling me until they were 6 weeks into the process, that a feral cat had gotten into one of our basements into a rental property, and it's a sand basement. So needless to say, it was flea infested. The mother cat got out, took all the kittens except this one, because I said, we need to now bomb the building. You have to seal it up. We found the cat, probably the kitten, 2 days after the mother had left, we estimate. And so because my background's counseling, I assume that the eating disorder was precipitated by the fact that she was without food and mother's milk for the 2 days.
Huh.
We have, every time we go away, we have somebody sit the cat, and we have to hide the food and anything that is edible. I mean, I found her eating plastic that has like a residual of food on it. I didn't know if there was, because we try to be holistic with our animals, I didn't know if there was something natural that I could put into her food as a supplement, maybe to help overset. That she has a problem that we always have to watch her weight, obviously, because she tries to, she just swallows your food. We try to give her just a very little bit of dry food.
Yeah.
We don't give her any canned food because we thought that that would be more fatty. We've talked to our vets. He suggested that, you know, he said her weight is okay now, but it's like a constant daily battle, you know.
Okay.
Cal, it's a challenge I don't know if I'm going to be able to help you with. If this cat has an eating disorder as a result of being left without food for 2 days as a newborn, I don't know what you're going to do to convince the cat that they don't have to feel that way anymore, other than just flooding the cat with food and worrying about the weight later. It is true that canned food has more calories than dry, although in many other ways, canned food is superior to dry food. But one way that dry food is easier is that you could leave a lot of it around and feed them what's called ad libitum. So that sounds like a good thing to do, is just leave dry food around. And this is generally something that I do not recommend people do, leaving food around and just replenishing the bowl every time it's empty. Because eventually most cats will eat too much and they'll get fat by the time they're 8, 9, 10 years of age.
Yeah.
And then it's harder to do something about it. But in this case, I would feed ad libitum, and I would have multiple bowls, all of them having dry food, some of having canned food, and see if over the years, tincture of time, we'll get this cat to get over its primal problem. What was that primal scream? The things that happen in the first days of life.
Right.
That's going to be a challenge.
I'll be honest with you. We have three animals, all rescue. And our black cat, who is probably 14 now, she used to be free feeding. Like, we used to leave a bowl of food, and she would get saturated and go back to it when she needed to. Since we've gotten this cat who is now, I don't know, 5 years old, we had to stop doing that because what happens is she will just keep eating.
Yeah.
She'll eat to the point that she can't even move. And so I stopped that, and about 3 years ago, we started doing my, because I used to deal with people with eating disorders, so my plan of attack was to only put a little bit of dried dog food, cat food,
yeah,
in the bottom of her dish a couple times a day. She seems to be, you know, she'll devour it, but she seems to be healthy, and I think that's the only way I can take care of it, because otherwise she can't move. She's to the point now that at least her stomach isn't touching the floor. You know?
Carol, we're out of time. I apologize.
Separate the cats. Maybe separate the five-year-old away from the other two.
Apologize to everyone in the world. We're out of time. Rhinebeck Equine Hospital, providing a team of equine specialists in medicine and surgery, open 24 hours, 365 days a year for emergency services. RhinebeckEquine.com. Don Muller Gallery, Northampton, Massachusetts, specializing in jewelry, custom designs, handcrafted glass, and gifts by American artists since 1978. Facebook and DonMullerGallery.com. Dr. Joseph Cohen, optometrist, eye examination, classic eyewear, contact lens fitting in historic Uptown Kingston, participating with MVP, Empire, Davis, VSP, Medicare, and other insurances. CohenOptometry.com. And the Preservation League of New York State, Albany, New York, protecting New York's historic buildings, districts, and landscapes since 1974. PreserveNYS.org. Oh, that's the end. Goodbye.